The power system in Europe faces similar challenges, transitioning away from fossil fuels, increasing electrification and enhancing resilience. As we in Sweden contemplate the necessary transformations of our power grid, we should also seek inspiration from countries that might be ahead of us. The Netherlands, for instance, has a significantly more strained energy system with limitations both in domestic production and its electricity network. That's why we today interview Jonas van der Boogaard, digital lead at Alliander, to understand how power markets, power networks need to evolve to accommodate a much more decentralized and complex system. This is the Energy Strategy Podcast. My name is Niklas Sigholm, and it's nice to have you with us. Jonas van der Boogaard, a warm welcome to the Energy Strategy Podcast.
Thank you for having me, yeah.
And you work at Alliander, and perhaps not all our listeners are familiar with your company.
Alliander develops and operates energy networks. That means that we are one of the larger distribution system operators in the Netherlands. And through our cables and pipes, we have over 300 customers in the Netherlands, both households but also companies. 3 million households and companies in total, which we provide from electricity, gas, and heating. And that means that we have, in the Netherlands, have over 90,000 kilometers of electricity grid we have to manage and operate, and over 40 kilometers of gas grid. And we're also investing in new networks like heating and extending that as well.
So you're a large utility company, and one of the reasons I find it interesting to talk to you is that I've seen the map showing how new production, new customers can connect to the electricity grid, and it was mostly red. As I understand it, in many parts of Netherlands, it's not possible to connect either as a producer or as a consumer. Is that right?
Yeah, at this moment in the Netherlands, it's our challenging times. We see that especially here in the Netherlands, the energy transition is moving at full speed. And we see that as a growing number of both customers, but also companies that are significantly investing in sustainability. For example, the number of solar panels alone, we see that it's increased by 25% in the last few years. And only in our area, we already have over 700,000 solar panels installed. These are huge numbers. And then I'm not even talking about the number of heat pumps that are installed in our area as well. And then we also have the movement from to e-mobility and moving cars from gas-focused cars to electric vehicles, which is a huge transition for us as a nation, but also specifically for us as a distribution grid operator. Because especially here in the Netherlands, we used to be a very gas-oriented country.
Right. As you're known as one of the countries in Europe who is most dependent on gas. And I guess that has a huge effect on the power grid as well. Because I guess as you invest in more renewables, it decreases also the what you used to have as a base load.
Yeah. So you see that in traditional, our total energy consumption, electricity was one of the smaller parts of that. Most of the energy consumption is related to heating, and which is very gas oriented here in the Netherlands. But now we see that changing. We see changing the role of gas becoming smaller. So you see the need for electricity is growing. And for example, the heat pumps are a great example on that because it means that gas-based heating is replaced by electricity-based heating. And the same you see with mobility, moving mobility from gas focus to electricity focus is also increasing the demand for electricity. And that's a huge change here for the Netherlands because we expect that needed grid capacity in the next 30 years will double or even three-double. And that's a huge consequence for companies like us because that means that we have to build and improve our networks way faster than we have ever done in the last few years. And even we see, if you're looking at those numbers and to put them in perspective, it means that we have to build over tens of thousands of new transformer stations. And we really have to open up one in the three streets to upgrade the cables to provide this extra capacity. And that's a huge task. And I would even say an impossible task because to get the manpower to do that especially given the labor situation here in the Netherlands, is impossible. And then also all the other things you have to arrange around it is making this an impossible task. So we really have to change the way we have been working for the last decades and really rethink the way we think we do the work and operate the grid and develop the grid and maintain the grid to still fulfill this energy transition, but do it in a smarter and a new way.
Because we're not really there yet in Sweden. I mean, we still can provide these stable grid contracts where you subscribe on a certain level and you can keep and you're guaranteed that. But as I understand you, you're already in the situation where that is no longer possible. And for you to have new customers in the grid, you have to rethink how you do this.
Yeah, exactly. So in the current situation, there's already a large part of our area which we're responsible for, which we at this moment are not able to provide customers with the opportunity to increase to a good capacity or for new customers to connect them to the grid, because there are areas that the demand grows so fast, there's a huge waiting list for those customers nowadays. And that's a huge problem, not only for us, but also for those customers, because that means that they have to wait until they can expand their businesses or start up new businesses.
So you have a big customer and we want this amount of power. And then you say, if you want a stable contract, please wait 10 years. But if you want it now, what can we do about it? And what is it you're doing about it? What kind of contracts are you developing for these companies or customers?
So the good news is that traditionally we only have one type of contract. So we had a contract which guarantees you 365 days, 24/7 hour, the grid capacity at a maximum level. But most of the time, the companies don't need that capacity all the time. So I've been now changing to a new type of contracts, which still provides customers with a partly firm contract. So they still have a degree of guarantee capacity, but that's much lower. And on top of that, we do offer a non-firm part on top of that to provide customers extra capacity when that's available, which is a great way of enabling new customers to connect to the grid, because we see that at most of the time, the grid capacity is only 50% of the capacity available. And because there is only a few moments a year that we're really stressing that grid, and that's causing the problem. So moving to more flexible contracts in this kind of way will help us and our customers to be connected more faster and allow them to expand their businesses or create new businesses.
Although I guess they would prefer a stable and predictable contract. But when you introduce this, how do you see the customers react to this?
Fully agree. Yeah? If you have the option to choose between both, the customers will prefer the grid capacity that guarantees you that grid capacity at all times. If they choose for that, they still can. The customers have that option. We don't push them to choose that. But the consequence for choosing their traditional contract is that they have to wait for many years. And for most customers, that waiting is not an option, because they may have huge consequences for their businesses. And sometimes they don't even have the opportunity to wait that long. So that other contract provides them a more quicker solution. For most customers, they're really happy that we now considering these alternative options and contracts, because that allows them to move on.
I also understand that in order to solve this problem, you also see networks of companies or customers join together in order to solve or perhaps use their different profiles in order to have a better usage of the grid connection. Is that right? Would you describe that for us, please?
So there's different forms of the ways we offer these contracts. So it can be in a 1-1 relation where we have one customers, but more and more we see also the concept of energy hubs existing here in the Netherlands. And you can see an energy hub, for example, as a group of companies in a particular area that they form an energy community together. which means that they have a fixed contract on an energy hub, let's say group level, with us as a grid operator. And they make sure that they stay between the boundaries of that contract on a local level, which means that they if there are companies which have different energy profiles, they can benefit from their one another's flexibility and capacity in a smarter way. So that in the end, even though they stay between the maximum capacity of the group on the energy level, this creates opportunity for each company to have a more capacity available on a local level.
Who helps them with the dispatch here? Do you help these energy hubs or do they solve that themselves?
It depends. Sometimes there are new organizations or companies stepping in this business, so they're providing the role and also the platform for those energy hubs. Sometimes they organize them themselves. It really depends on the energy hubs, and you see it. This is a really new concept, so it's evolving, and it's very interesting to see a lot of innovation also coming from these energy hubs to maximize the potential that's there.
Okay, so you're the digital strategy lead. And I mean, just trying to translate that you have 3 million customers right now, and thousands of them are transferring from completely stable contracts to base load contracts and some sort of variable contract on the top. How does that translate to your digital capabilities and what you need to do?
That has a huge impact, because it means a lot when you one thing it sounds simple. Okay, we move from these fixed contracts, which guarantee to capacity at all times, to a part where we say you still have a fixed burn, but you also have a non-firm part. The challenge there is for us as Aliander is okay. When is that non-firm capacity available? Because that means that it's most of the time available, but sometimes it's not. And the challenge is to determine what is available. That has led to huge transition at our organization, especially the change to a more digital company. And because we used to be the network itself used to be very simple. We had like very predictable power production, which was mostly from central power factories like gas centrals and customers at the end and consumers at the end. But now you see with all this move to sustainable energy, this system is becoming way more complex, and production consumption is happening all kind of levels. To be able to know exactly when and where in the grid what's available, it requires a whole new set of capabilities to provide that. And there we see, especially as Aliander, that digitalization is key. Yeah, so personally, I really believe that we, where we come from, we used to be an organization which develops, operates, and maintains electricity grid, gas grids, and heating grids. I'd say there's now a fourth grid we're managing as well, and that's the data grid. Because we heavily investing in getting more insight into the grid. That means that we are increasing the number of measurements in our grid in all kinds of levels. So you have, for example, smart meters, which we are rolling out at customer level, but we're also placing many measurement points in our grid as well. And this provides us more detailed insight in the energy flows that's happening around our grid, which is great, because those measurements provides us near real-time information what's happening in the grid. And that also allows us to build on other new capabilities like forecasting, to not only have insight in what's happening today in the grid, but also what's happening tomorrow in the grid or the day after. And that information provides us with the information to also calculate and predict what's the available grid, and also stress test that one on multiple scenarios, which is a requirement for us to be able to provide these new type of contracts to customers.
It's like you said, this is a huge change. And when I'm thinking about what we're going through here in Sweden, I guess it's the same story, right? We're going from utility companies who are used to asset management and reinvesting in the grid, creating new capacity through new lines and transformers and whatnot. And now this change is happening where you have to have this fourth digital grid as well. How, if you listen to your CEO, how has this changed the strategy? How much of a core is digital capability now? How central of a position has it gotten in how Aliander allocates resources, would you say?
That really changed. I've been working for Aliander 8 years, and when I started working at Aliander, IT and digitalization was mostly seen as a supporting function. Where if you look at our company strategy today, digitalization is seen as one of the core processes or core focus points of our strategy. And because we've seen it, it's not only supporting it, it's making our business possible. That change has really helped us to make this transition as a company, but also has a huge impact. So we, by making digitalization part of our core business, we really stepped up in both investments in that part, but also changing the way we look at processes and think about processes and really think about how we can take benefit of all the digital possibilities in rethinking the way we do work and not only focus on doing more work, but also do it in a smarter and more efficient and effective way.
Right. So this has also affected a lot of how you work internally and your internal processes as well.
Exactly. Yes. And it's not always, I have to say, it's not always an easy transition to go through. And it not always goes perfect. And I think we still have a lot to do. And looking ahead of times and all the possibilities I had, I think we still have a long journey to go through. But I personally believe it's a very promising journey to look forward to.
How did you start off? I mean, if you were to be in Sweden, I mean, Aliander would be, I mean, the biggest utility company, I guess, in the country. So you're a quite big company, right? And you have a lot of resources compared to a lot of utilities in Sweden. And how did you develop your strategy? Because as you started to mention, this is a quite complex question. It's not only that you have to have congestion management and forecasting, you have to have mitigation processes, and you have to have new power models. You have to really invest in so many different capabilities. How did you start off by developing? How did you develop a roadmap for which paths to choose in order to create all these capabilities, especially in the backdrop of how fast this transition is moving?
Even for a company of our size, this is a huge challenge. And it's one of the reasons we actively, also from a strategic perspective in our digitization strategy, look for a collaboration with partners and others. Because us both on the huge, because we use investment, but it also requires a lot of knowledge. That's one of the things that we see. There's great potential to work together with others in the industry. For example, universities, which have great knowledge on this topic, but also other utilities, both inside the Netherlands, because even though we are quite a large DSO, there are also other large DSOs in the Netherlands as well, but also outside the Netherlands, because we see, even though our challenges are not everywhere the same, there is a lot of overlap between those challenges. And there's also a great opportunity to work together there, because doing by yourself, there's only that much you can do or that much speed you can achieve. If by collaborating and working together with others, we can really step up there and make the effort together for one side less money, but also with a higher speed. And I think there's also great things to learn from other industries which go through these transitions before us. I think it's great aspiration from these other industries to learn from and to be inspired.
There's so many things that you say that are interesting, but I want to go back to the start of this. I mean, one of the, perhaps my prejudice here, but I mean, I guess the traditional way to view this would be, okay, let's hire in a lot of people, let's start developing either the software that we need or the capability we need internally, or let's go out and ask our network of suppliers and see what they what we can buy from them. But what you're saying is that you already in the start of chose a more collaborative manner because of why? What was the problem? Why did you need to go that way? Although I understand that's obviously a good thing to collaborate with universities, but that might not be the most commercial pathway every time. Why did you end up there?
I think the automotive industry is a great example. So I think there's a lot of similarities there between our industry and their industry, because you see, the traditional car was also a very asset-based car. But the car of today and tomorrow, more a computer than a car, to say. I think the Tesla is a great example of that. And you see now also traditional car companies like Volkswagen, Mercedes, BMW, also going through huge transition to move from building traditional cars to building a software-defined vehicle. And that requires also a huge change, and also requiring to build new capabilities, just like us. I think it's what is very amazing in that sector is that especially the car companies in Germany realized that they were behind some of the other manufacturers like Tesla. And for them to catch up, they needed to collaborate, because it took them too much time, too much money, and too much resources to do themselves. So they decided that let's create Automotive Linux. So we have this open fundamental platform, which we can use to build those software-defined vehicles on, which we all need, all these base needs, and let's build that together in an open and collaborative way. And then, of course, each organization has the opportunity to build specific features on top of that, which make them unique for their own brands, and also differentiate them one another. But they save a huge amount of cost, resource, and time by working on this fundamental base together. And I think that aspirational is also what we took in our strategy, is let's also see which common building blocks we need in this digital grid. And let's see if we can work together on these fundamental building blocks together with others requiring those same building blocks.
Now, that's a great example, seeing that the automotive industry is a highly competitive industry, and there's still a basic platform that you could collaborate around without destroying the individual brands. And I guess the similarities and also the rate of competitiveness would make it even easier for utilities to do this, actually. That's very interesting. But what did your network of suppliers think? Weren't they, buy this off the shelf from us instead?
I think there's a little bit of a challenge there, because also this shift to the new capabilities not only is it impacting us as organization, but also impacting our suppliers, and is also making us come up with new requirements towards the traditional solutions suppliers offer. And the challenge we saw there is that, especially there was in the Netherlands, we are one of the more front runners in requiring these new capabilities, which was first challenging, because we saw that the more suppliers we traditionally work with, not all their solutions fulfill the needs we require in this new context.
So you couldn't find what you were looking for in the market. Is that right?
Yeah, and that was a challenge. And also for the suppliers, because since this transition in Netherlands on some areas goes faster than in other areas of Europe, made it for them difficult to see, okay, which speed we are going to fulfill those requirements. And it, of course, really depends on the solution and the supplier. So sometimes we saw there was no other option than to decide, okay, we may need to for some of our capabilities to invest in those capabilities ourselves, or find new partners which also have similar needs in this area and see if we can collaborate there. And that resulted that we also increased collaboration with new partners which we traditionally don't work to.
Oh, that's interesting. What kind of partners is that?
I think one of the greatest examples we have is I was talking about the forecasting capability which we have been needing and working on. We started building this ourselves because there was no specific back in the day forecasting engine, which was really specifically built on forecasting the energy flows in the grid, giving all the renewables. But we came into discussion with RT, which is the French TISO, transmission system operator in France. We came in discussion with them, and they were in a similar need as well. So they were also discussing with vendors and not finding the solution they needed. And they also decided on building that capability themselves. And then we mentioned, hey, we have been building this now for a couple of years. And yes, it has never been used in a transmission system operator use case. But if you look at from a little more higher over perspective, it's pretty much the same. So our assumption was that it would probably fit like 80% of their future needs. And that made us decide, okay, let's make this forecast engine open source available for them. So they can take their investment instead of starting from scratch and take that investment and resources to make sure that 20% future fit, which is missing, has been realized. And they did. And the great news is that they did that in way less time. The time to market is significantly increased for way less money, which is a great thing. And it's even better because we both see that this capability is not something it's done, because we see the forecasting get more and more important, and new technology innovations allows us also to do and continue to improve it. And now, since we are working on this together, and we can share the burden of that innovation and work together and share the costs, but also benefit from one other expertise and resources to realizing that. And it's only an example of only the two of us working on this, but this has already been very beneficial. And imagine if this, we already see now this community growing with universities stepping in this project, and also other organizations looking into.
And more utilities.
And more utilities looking in this project as well. And I think that only shows there's so much more potential in working on this together. And I think this not only applies for utilities working together, but also for vendors up in as well.
Right. And I mean, predicting or forecasting the level of power from solar is going to become more and more important for any utility in Europe, seeing as they also can, I mean, solve a lot of problems, obviously, but they can also create a lot of problems in the grid. And what a wonderful thought if the utilities in Europe could at least cooperate on the basic foundation of what you need in order to have good forecasts for this, rather than, I guess, what, hundreds of different unique solutions to this problem. Is that sort of summarizing the raison d'être for open sourcing this?
I would say yes. I think because we see that, especially in our sector, there's a lot of reinventing the wheel over and over. Combining those resources is one side beneficial, but on the side, it really allows us to speed up.
So this is a quite broad question, I guess, but going open source, I guess that also is somewhat of a mental conflict of how you've done things before. What was needed in your organization to adopt this sort of open source strategy on creating your digital capabilities? Or was it just evident that provided these arguments that you've already said, it's like, okay, there's no other option. But I guess there's a lot of different questions there regarding security and whatnot.
I think it was definitely not that obviously in the beginning, because move from recognizing digitalization key strategy versus Aliander to the step making implementing that and realizing that it was a raw journey. When we started to invest and building up the capacity, we came to be realizing there are a lot of factors to take into account. Security of course being one of them, but also open source is one which we on the forehand didn't recognize as a great enabler. But during that journey, I started to realize that need for collaboration. and there are different ways you can organize collaboration. But we came especially in connection with Valve Energy back in the day, and with not really understanding open source back then, but they helped us to realize, hey, this open source is not only a great enabler to build products, because we use many open source products in our bio tools, but also open source is a great enabler for our strategy to collaborate. So that helped us realizing and seeing open source as one of the means for more collaboration. And that will not say that open source is the only way it can be organized, but we now see it as one of the strategic options to do so. And over time, it also took learning, because your first, especially our first open source project, which we open source, for example, a forecasting project, and being in an open source collaboration with an organization, RTE, which is a French organization in a different country, is also a learning experience, because we used to be a very traditional Dutch company, really focused on the Netherlands, and for our work, Dutch is the language to go to, and now transitioning in an open source collaboration, you're moving to English because Dutch is not much spoken elsewhere, is a journey which you have to learn.
I can imagine a lot of comfort zones that you need to break. So you started a Linux foundation around energy. And for anyone who's interested in this, you could visit, you could just search on LF Energy Foundation and you'll find the page for this. You have lots of different modules now. But tell us a bit about this cooperation. How does that work?
It's a really open foundation around open source in the energy sector. And it's Linux Foundation Energy is part of the Linux Foundation. So it takes the lessons learned from large open source projects like Linux, but also Kubernetes, and brings that and makes that available for the energy sector. So one side, it's great knowledge source to learn from other great open source projects and see how we can use those best practices and those lessons learned for the projects in our sector. On the other side, it's also great organization, network organization, to get in touch with other organizations, specifically in the energy sector, so other TSOs and DSOs, but also vendors and universities. They're also adopting open source or on it in the journey of their transition to open source, and also share experience with them, because there's many ways that our sector is also unique and has its own challenges. So being able to connect with peer organizations that are a little bit ahead of you in that journey, or at least on some parts in more advanced, and learn from them how they are doing that. Another way around, it's also a great way to share and ideas over potential new projects or projects they are internally working on and maybe can be open source and work together on, has been leading, because we have been involved in Linux Foundation Energy since 2019, and that has been leading to many new open source projects in this space, because I mentioned forecasting, but we also have this great project on grid calculations, which we open source, and now also working together on several members of the Linux Foundation Energy, and also a project in the space of substations. And I think that LF Energy has been very helpful in that transition. That said, joining LF Energy is not a requirement if you want to participate in open source or in any of the open source projects. You can do so even without memberships. It's definitely not limited, but it helps if you are building up that capacity.
So talking about learning from others, how have you organized yourselves in order to be well equipped to use open source? Because I mean, I guess it's networking is one part of it, but trying to transfer the knowledge from the, and also the code, obviously, from the Open Source Foundation to your own operations. How have you managed that? How have you organized that?
That's a really great question. So back in 2019, when we joined LF Energy and set up the first version of our open source strategy, we started to recognize the need for also a group of people to really implement that open source strategy and make it and operate it. And that requires a group of people with all kinds of expertise, from legal expertise, because open source is also about open source licenses, which has a legal perspective. There's also a different correlation with security, procurement, and IT. And that was one of the reasons in 2020 that we decided to start with an open source program office. Started very small, but making sure that we at least had some people with different expertise from different areas in the organization bring together this knowledge, but also go to a group of people for the organization, all kinds of questions around open source. And that group that I have been leading since then has really helped us to mature in open source management on all kinds of perspectives. Right? So this is about using open source internally in a controlled and secure manner, but also enabling our teams to collaborate to open source projects and even set up the processes to bring internal projects to the open source community and grow from there has been something we have been facilitating from the open source program office here in Alianda, and has been very helpful in that journey. And although there's many ways you can organize an OSPO, my personal advice is it really helps if you have, even if it's very small, one or two people, but having some people with really this expertise around open source and helping your organization mature in that.
How many do you have specifically around this topic of open source? I mean, if you add in the legal parts, how many are involved in this project of developing and then implementing from open source?
Yeah, so if you look purely to the OSPO team, I would say there's like around 10 people involved. But on full-time basis, I would say it's more like two people full-time on FTA basis. So it's not that many. It's small, but it's important to have the right people on board and have them available on when you need it. But you don't need to have a large team to make that step. And even when we started, it was smaller. Most importantly, it just helps to have at least this group available. And then, of course, we have a lot of more project teams working on open source, but they are part of the regular business.
But if I pose the question from another perspective, how many developers have been involved, would you say, or think, in take the forecasting module, for instance? Because that's a really scarce resource, right? Getting system or programmers or developers. How many can you attain from being part of this network?
So we have one team working on this in Alianda perspective. There are about six people on that team. And there were like really two senior developers in that, which really are really experts in this domain. But now having them connect to a similar team at RTE and other organizations, we are really extending that capacity. And it really is helpful because those experts have great ideas and they can share their ideas with one another. But now they can also think about these, share ideas and talk about ideas and with those others in the network as well. And that provides way more insight. So I really see that this 1+1=3 idea is really, really coming here together.
All right. So you have five developers or somewhere around there. And then another company has five and another company has five and they have universities. And all of a sudden you perhaps have a large group of developers doing this simultaneously.
Yeah, and you're putting in the same investment. So I already say it's open source collaboration is a way to get more incremental innovation out of the finite budget you have.
But is it really secure, though? I guess I have to post this question again, because I guess a lot of the utilities would think, I mean, we have these laws, we just joined NATO, there's a lot of talk about war and security in Sweden, and then perhaps a lot of people would be scared of thinking, but whoa, if we open up to open AI, we open the floodgates to, I don't know, different security threats that we never faced before. How would you respond to that?
That's a question I get quite often. And I think it's also good that we ask ourselves that question many times, because security in our sector is a key priority. But it's also important to recognize that software being an open source or closed software doesn't guarantee any security. Also, being open source or closed software doesn't mean that open source software is less secure or more secure. It really depends on the software. And open source software can be very secure because you look back at the example of the automotive industry, our cars run up on open source software. Even the rockets we sent to the moon run on open source software. So in the most critical environments, open source software is used. I also take this example from Gartner, is that Gartner states that in more than 95% of the organizations use open source software in critical environments. So open source and security can perfectly go hand in hand. That, of course, means that you can guarantee it, that you have to take the measures in place to make sure it's secure and keep secure. But that's the same with closed source software. Also there, you cannot, if you buy it, you have to audit it. You have to keep it up to date. It's the same for open source software. You have to take those measurements in place. So there's a lot of perspective, or at least still people see open source something of being less secure, or something that's developed by some developers in the free time on the Sundays. And sometimes that's the case, but most open source projects are run, built by companies, large companies.
It sounds like your pitch is that if you have like the project pyramid of cost, time and quality, you'll increase all three of them, and you won't necessarily get the downsides in the security either. So you save money, you speed up the development, and you get a higher quality of your product because the collaboration increases. It really sounds incredible. What would be the things that you've learned that is really hard or that you need to take into consideration before doing this?
I think there's a huge potential open source, and I think we are only in the start of the journey to benefit of that potential. But it also is important to recognize that it's a new way of working and a new way of approaching things. It's also good to consider it takes time to build expertise around open source, and also how you procure open source, how you make open source, do open source security, how you do open source development. It's also important that you invest in building up that capacity to fully benefit of it. So that's one remark I want to make. Another remark I have to make is where open source is most suitable is for common building blocks which are generic. If you have a very specific solution or case, which is very unique for your company only, open source is not always the best fit. You can build it better by yourself than doing that in an open source way, because you need to have that common basis to build that open source community.
How many issues are like that, though? I think, because I saw one of the things that you're developing now is as a module for chargers and EVs. My thought here is that you also need then to, I guess, talk a lot about standardization of data. Is that also something that is a part of this, how you standardize the protocols and everything?
Yeah. So I think those two things go hand in hand. So moving to more open source allows us to create more common building blocks, but be able to also integrate those common building blocks in our IT landscape also puts pressure on moving to more international data standards and communication standards, which is also, I can imagine, is a challenge for us as an organization, because we used to have quite specific standards which were really company specific. And now we are moving, and not only open source is pushing this step, but because also we are more and more interconnected with other organizations, and there's more trends pushing us to adopt more international standards. But that's also something important to recognize, that there need to be a willingness to standardize in the way you work, but also the way you communicate and the way in which standards you apply.
So this has been really interesting. If I ask you to be the forecaster now, and where is this heading if you stare down a couple of years down? What kind of capabilities do you need to have, and what kind of problems are you solving for the grid in the Netherlands?
Personally, I'm very positive. So I think although this energy transition, which is speeding up, is providing great challenges, it's also a very good thing. So I look forward to a future which we have an energy system that runs on renewable energy, allows us to live our lives in a comfortable way, benefiting from e-mobility, but also doing this in a smart way, taking a full benefit of technology to maximize energy consumption. At the moment, there's a lot of sustainable energy available, and minimize energy consumption on moments when there's only a few available.
For millions of customers in real time.
Yeah, in real time, yeah.
Almost minute by minute as well.
By minute, yeah. And that's a future I'm looking very much forward to. And I think to make that future possible, we need to take full advantage of all the technology capabilities. And that means investing in AI and smart models, but also in measurements and IoT devices to make that possible. And I also believe that to make that all possible, we cannot do that alone. Not even here in the Netherlands, working together with the other DSOs, we really have to step up this collaboration on an international level to make this possible, because this is going to require a huge investment, and we can only do that to collaborate. And I always take that example of Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. They building this, they are facilitating this transition to the cloud. And but even them, they could not build the fundamentals by themselves. Even they have the largest innovation budgets around the world. And they are collaborating, for example, on the Kubernetes project, which is a crucial platform running all those cloud systems. They're working on that together. Because even they, and they are the largest companies around the world, have the large R&D budgets, but even they recognize there's so much to do and there's such a need of investment and resources, but also speed required that we cannot do that ourselves. We really need to take that example and put that into a perspective in our sector. And if we are able to do that, we can make the impossible possible.
So seeing the amount of change and the speed in which it needs to happen, we need more collaboration. That's a really sympathetic thought. Thank you so much for taking time and speaking to me, Jonas. It was really interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and I hope this will inspire others.